Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope all is well wherever you are listening. Thanks for tuning in. Again this week, a little break from the election routine. I will be returning to my press and election focus next week as we enter the final weeks of the election campaign. I have investigative journalist Sam Soule and political analyst Angelo Fick lined up for the following weeks. My guest this week is Durban-born Gabi Ngobo. Gabi is, or describes herself, as you'll hear, as an artist, curator, and an educator, although not in any particular order or in any particular description, as you will hear. She wants to stay free of any professional labeling. She calls herself a disruptor, and she certainly wants to provoke and to unlock new ways of thinking about art, and I suppose as a consequence, the world around us. Gabi recently returned to South Africa after 18 months in Berlin, where she curated, along with a team that she selected, the Berlin Biennale. And before that, she spent a year in Sao Paulo, where she co-created the 32nd Sao Paulo Biennale. So we chatted. It was quite an intense discussion, I suppose. And then we chatted about curating, collaboration, her approach to those concepts, those parts of her work, and to art in general. I hope you enjoy now my chat with Gabi. Gabi, thanks a lot for making the time here today. I appreciate that. You're a curator by profession, is that correct? And I just wanted to know what that actually means.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm a curator by profession necessarily, but in the work that I do, curatorial practice is one of them.
How would you describe yourself then? Do you describe yourself as anything?
I do describe myself, if need be, but I often describe myself as an artist, curator, and educator.
Okay, well, that's nice. Then we've got a couple of things to talk about, at least. But your background then is as an artist. Is that your sort of initial? Are you trained as an artist?
Yeah, my first professional background is as an artist, which means that my first degree, I went to an art school.
Yes.
And I studied art.
Okay.
I did my MA in curatorial studies.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. I didn't even know that was something you could study. I thought curating was a bit like jazz. You know, you just kind of had a feel for something and off
you went. And then I realized after studying that it is like jazz. It should be.
Wow. Okay. I got that right. For me... Well, maybe you tell me what curating is then.
Well, I mean, different people come from different perspectives when it comes to the profession of curating or of making exhibitions. There are people who work at museums as curators, which means that this is also a profession plus a job. And in terms of myself, I think of myself as someone who every now and then engages in curatorial practice or in curatorial projects. But I don't like to sit around thinking about what next exhibition I want to do. So I think of it as more as a sensibility and an embodied, you know, kind of practice that doesn't have a beginning or an end.
It kind of takes its own flow in a way, as your life flows as well.
Absolutely.
You draw a distinction between having a profession and having a job.
Yes, because I don't have a job, but I do. When I did my MA in curatorial studies, it became clear for me that I don't want, at least for a long time, this to be a label mm-hmm. you know, let or a badge that I wear.
Right.
Which meant that I did not want immediately to come out of that Kyoto school and maybe look for a museum job,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted it. I wanted my ideas to kind of live freely, so that I can be in control of them or in better control of them.
Yeah.
So that I can exercise them in different ways, not within constraints of an institution, although I do collaborate with institutions.
Yes, or even in the constraints of a perceived definition of your profession as a curator. Yes, so
yeah,
you kind of
yeah.
You know, you have that flexibility of approach and purpose, I suppose.
I do. I mean, I do for now.
Could change any moment. I'm interested when you say, you know, and that's how I think sort of understand the term curator, that it's kind of very much in a gallery space, and it's sort of more person that would be in charge of buying art for a gallery. But you are more, from what I can understand, a person that puts together sort of more, well, I the curator I understand is building a body of work around the identity of a particular gallery or space, whereas you are kind of dropping into spaces trying to say something around a certain theme or expressing the work of a particular artist. Does that sort of, how does that change the sort of theme-based, multi-artist, curated collection as opposed to working around the works of one particular artist?
I guess it does depend. I mean, traditionally, a curator and the word itself means somebody who takes care. So somebody who takes care of a collection in a museum, but it may extend to somebody who takes care of artists. I prefer a different approach. I mean, I don't want to take care. You know, I want to disrupt, actually.
Mm-hmm.
In order to construct something, you know, to find if we can kind of unlock ourselves from, you know, from being kind of stuck in a particular way of doing things. So it's not for destruction for destruction's sake.
Purpose, right, for destruction's sake,
but,
yeah.
But just to kind of unsettle and to create a space of undoing certain things that we no longer question. You know, to kind of point at the problems that were never ours in the first place, and also to kind of look for, you know, our own problems and our own solutions to those problems. And often the curatorial practice is of course defined elsewhere as a profession, and so are museums. We cannot longer afford to not have museums or not to think through museums anymore. But we can think about what a museum, for example, in Johannesburg is or can be, or what its potentials are in Johannesburg, without having to look too far.
I think, I mean, do you find that's maybe an issue in some senses with South African art in general? I mean, I'm by no means an expert. I've been to the Wits Art Gallery a couple of times, the Johannesburg Art Gallery. Is there still a sort of very, do you find a conservative approach to the way those spaces relate both to the art that they are exhibiting and the way they relate to their surroundings?
I mean, I think museums often work with certain constraints. I mean, which are norms that basically remain unquestioned and they're seen as a norm. I think a space like the Johannesburg Art Gallery, for example, has a lot to reflect on based on its surroundings, which are surroundings when you look at the area of Johannesburg Art Gallery, Joubert Park, etc. You can kind of see how the city was planned around that. And you find similar places in European cities, especially in England,
where the city has changed around the environment or the context of the gallery has changed.
There's a cultural space and a big park, and you know, it's the same with the National Gallery in Cape Town. There is a, you know, the gallery and the park,
the gardens,
if you go to England, you kind of notice the same kind of spatial arrangements, which in Johannesburg, you know, those spatial arrangements they have other a different kind of texture now.
The sort of nature of the city has transformed or changed, absolutely. And maybe the gallery hasn't adapted to that change.
I mean, I would say that the gallery is always trying to to adapt to the change. It's something that you cannot avoid trying to do. And it's quite interesting to look at the history of the Johannesburg Art Gallery, because they keep on changing the entrance, for example, south and then to and you never know which way you're gonna come. And sometimes you come into the back, or maybe it's the front, but the exhibition starts on the other side. So this dilemma of not knowing where to face, I think it's quite an interesting dilemma in itself, and something that
reflects something about the gallery and the city, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is starting to happen with JAG, because Kwezi Gule is someone I've known for a long time, who's taken over the space now, and I think the exhibition, his first exhibition in the gallery, was really interesting, which was titled "Your Faves Are Problematic," and you know, kind of like taking the collection itself and asking it questions, and I think that is quite critical, you know.
Yes, I was going to ask you that, how you see your role as, you want to try and force some, not force, you want to engage with an audience to perhaps think about something in a different way. Are you trying to also maybe ask the artist as well to reinterpret their art, or is it... I'm just thinking of that relationship between the art, the artist, and the viewer, and how do you see that relationship when you are putting a program together?
Well, I'm quite interested. I know that the idea of a viewer or an audience, I'm a bad audience myself, I know, but I think the idea of an audience for me is always a mysterious one, so... It's hard, and I don't think it's interesting for me to be working towards something and thinking about this thing that is so mysterious. But what I try to do is create an experience that would, you know, kind of compel people to work, you know, so that I don't, I'm not the person giving everything. I can set certain things.
So you're just putting little hints down almost.
Place, and then you know, kind of expect that more work is done with the encounter with the other people, or let's say the audience. I'm quite interested in that space of kind of also disrupting the way that we see and the way that we perceive of events, because often we don't know what happens behind the scenes. We just want a ready-made object and it's there, and we then consume. Mm. But I'm not interested in that space. I'm interested in a space that functions kind of differently. So when I work on curatorial projects, be they exhibitions or events or text, I try to force myself. I mean, it's not something that is easy to do. And especially if I don't want to always repeat myself, because I get bored so quickly.
Right.
And I always want to kind of twist things and kind of let people look at things in a different way. Which is, I think, it's also the function of art in itself, is that you know, artists want to reflect on society, on a political landscape, on identity, etc., and to initiate a dialogue, or to initiate ways of asking questions that will propel us into the next phase, you know, call it a future. And I think in this we can be able to dislodge ourselves from being stuck in a kind of a loop, always saying the same thing, always running out of, I don't know, the grammar or the vocabulary of grappling with life as it takes shape. And I think in South Africa that's really important, because things happen so quickly. There's drama every day. There's something to think about. There's something to unpack. And we always have to think fast and move fast and carefully at the same time.
I was just thinking about that whole in Kandla thing, you know, it seems like so long ago and so kind of innocent, and it's, you know, just an innocent time for this
country. we move on so fast.
But it's almost like you're trying to that's what I was trying to sort of get at. It's almost like you're trying to get people to look at even perhaps a familiar work of art in a different way by placing it in a particular context.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm always interested in that. I mean, my main interest is how artists look at history and kind of, you know, how we package a particular historical narrative. In that it doesn't seem to repeat or to sell the goal first, but it kind of transforms into something that is more liberating, that, you know, people or young people can see and see a future instead of seeing the same conditions that have placed us where we are. And I think that is our role, to show that there is, you know, there's another world out there. There's many other worlds out there.
Yeah, you said you're not a good viewer yourself. I mean, what does that mean in the context of somebody who obviously has to view quite a lot of art in their day to day?
I have to, but I don't have to. I mean, I'm a bad audience. I know I tend to miss a lot of things, but I mean, I look at things differently. I don't have to be at every exhibition.
No, sure. And I think I mean, that is quite a skill. Well, not a skill. I mean, it's a nice thing to have, I think, to look at things differently. That is,
it's the opposite of FOMO. I heard that there's this thing called JOMO, which I didn't know about.
A FOMO, I know. JOMO, I'm not so.
JOMO is the joy of missing.
Oh, yeah. That's my wife. She couldn't be bothered at the time. Me, I'm always looking for the party.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit, anyway. You also then, I mean, for example, you've curated some quite important, are they called exhibitions? The Biennale in Berlin, for example, is one of the sort of as I understand it, in the art world, one of the sort of primary art events on the artistic calendar. There are, of course, a number of others. And there's also, I saw you'd been to Sao Paulo, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
When was that?
This was in, the Biennale itself opened in September 2016, so I was there for a year before.
In Sao Paulo. Yeah. So, and then you said Berlin for 18 months. So you kind of, I mean, you are immersing yourself not only in an art project, but in a city, right? I mean, you kind of, you have an opportunity to really take on board so much. And I'm just wondering, how do you sort of develop a relationship with a city now that you working in, and how do you track your ideas change? I mean, do you come in with one idea and you think, oh shit, no, this is a bit different to what I was thinking, and then you have to kind of change course along the way? I mean, how does the city impact on, even if you have an idea about the message or whatever you're wanting to curate, how does the city and its history and its present, I suppose, impact on that process?
And my approach is to remain open. I mean, I know if I have an idea, and that if I choose to live in a place and be local, or, you know, try to be local, or ask myself this question, how can I be local? I know that for sure things will change, you know, for sure they have to. I'll be worried if they don't. Mm. And for me, it is important to immerse myself into the city. And part of that, especially in Sao Paulo, because it's different to Berlin, for example, where in Berlin you can... the transport system, the public transport system, is so easy kind of to navigate. In Sao Paulo, I went there a month before I was to move there. Not a month before I was to move there, but I went for a month after I knew I was going to move there for a year, just to get a sense of it, and to be able to buy things in a supermarket in Portuguese, and to be able to take public transport, so to understand the bus system. And for me, that was quite critical, because I didn't want to be the person who's jumping in cabs all of the time.
Especially if there is some sort of network there for you to use.
And there's definitely a network. It looks impossible when you know, outside of it. And I got lost a lot. And sometimes I got lost purposely, always with the Google Map, always locating myself.
Rebecca Solnit, she writes about that, sometimes getting lost just for the sake of getting lost.
Yeah, and it's you can learn a lot about the city and where you are in the city. I like karaoke, so I have to find different spots.
The hot Sao Paulo karaoke bars.
Karaoke bars, and, you know, of course, different restaurants, local places, you know. And
what sort of music, what songs do you like singing when you sing karaoke?
I have very limited songs. And they're, sometimes it's Prince.
Oh, that's nice.
I Would Die For You. I mean,
right, a bit of R&B, sort of slow.
Whitney Houston.
Some of that slow, sloppy, sloppy tunes.
Absolutely. Amy Winehouse.
Oh, man. Got tears in the eyes of all the audience. We used to have a place in Stockholm. It was a heavy metal karaoke.
Oh, wow.
It's a hard rock karaoke. Yeah, every Sunday night and every Tuesday night. Jeez, I tell you what. Used to go for it.
Wow.
Everyone jumping around. Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah.
Do you speak Portuguese?
I don't speak Portuguese, but I did pick up a lot of Portuguese when I was there.
I'm just wondering how that language thing then works as well. Again, sort of looking at the relationship to the city in Berlin as well. Although in Berlin, I suppose a lot of people speak pretty good English, but Sao Paulo would be a bit different, I imagine.
A lot different. A whole lot more different. So you can walk around the city and not talk to people, basically. Though people try to speak to you, but as soon as you show that you do not speak Portuguese, people are not interested. So I just learned
the basics. Yeah.
I mean, the language that or the way of communicating that I kind of thought worked for me was really to party a lot.
That's cool.
So, like, I was always on the dance floor and I met a lot of people on the dance floor.
Yeah.
And I started to know a lot of people because...
Just because.
I just, you know, I just like, and I make sure that my energy levels would support my work and this,
yeah,
you know, and for it to work together. So,
and I mean, Berlin and Sao Paulo, those are two cities they like to dance, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. In Berlin, I calm down a bit.
You were 2 years older.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, only one.
I suppose it's a different
twice.
It's a different vibe, Berlin, isn't it? I mean,
it
compared
is.
To
also
Sao
like
Paulo.
It's a party city.
It has got a great legacy of famous underground kind of dance basements, doesn't
yeah.
it? And things like that.
And
I mean,
DJs,
I've not, I only spent a weekend there. I think, I mean, the thing for me about Berlin was that you see its history like so. Sort of out in the open, you know, the Berlin Wall, the Nazi regime.
Mm-hmm.
There are buildings there. There are museums there. There's mm-hmm. that sort of link to the past.
Mm.
How did that sort of, particularly now with the Berlin Biennale, did that kind of enter your? I mean,
yeah,
how did that sort
absolutely.
Of enter your work there?
I think when you're working,
given that you do say you have this interest in history, and
yeah, I do, and of course when you're working on an event that is named the city, the name of the city is there in the name of the event itself. It does not make sense not to consider
mm-hmm.
The history of the place. I was asked to propose for the Berlin Biennale to consider that it was the 10th anniversary. It's the 20th anniversary, actually. But it would be the 10th version of the Berlin Biennale.
Yeah, right.
And I think that kind of opens up a space where I had to kind of think about what is the language of commemoration, because I like always to think, I don't go straight, look straight into an event. I like to sit kind of, you know, adjacent to it in order to think differently about commemoration, because commemoration in itself is not interesting to me. But I can see it as an opportunity to kind of look with skew eyes. Almost as if you're trying to look to see your nose, you know, which is a very difficult thing to do.
Squinting
your eyes. So that also what comes out of that look is not so apparent or so, so clear. Because I don't think, you know, like it's history is... sometimes I think that history is not history, you know.
Mm.
And I think coming from South Africa, I know that for sure. And which is also why that we titled the Biennale, "We Don't Need Another Hero," you know, because of certain things that, you know, became clear through the student movements here, and the fall list, the roads must fall, and the fees must fall movements. That's, you know, what is here celebrated now may not be celebrated in the future, and which is the very same thing with Berlin too. And in fact, with the post-colonial movement, Berlin post-colonial, I think that's what it's called. They started a movement which is called Roads Must Fall.
Huh.
But roads, as in streets,
which
was calling for a renaming of certain streets and embankments and even subway stations sometimes that were named after people who had a problematic
history,
and especially in
that's fascinating
to colonialism. So we arrived in this kind of Berlin, where a lot of spaces, a lot of museums were thinking about questioning the history, questioning collections, in a space like this, you have to realize, speak to as many people as possible, and to find a position. You don't want to do the same thing. It's not about refusing to do it, but it's not about abusing the platform, because it is a powerful platform to say that, oh, now you are doing it because you are in this platform. But to find a different kind of rhythm to speak with, instead of to the place, and this is what we try to do, to speak with, to be in conversation with, and not to lecture, and not to say, perhaps we know better, or our voices can be louder because we have this international platform. So that was something that was important for us to do.
Yes, you say us, because, I mean, you do work, there are a number of you working together, right? I mean, the curation is a collaboration,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you choose a team, or is that a team that's there that you're in charge of, or how does that work?
Well, in Berlin, I chose a team to come and join me, to form the curatorial team.
Right.
And usually that's often how I work. I don't like to work alone.
And would that be different people in a different place? I mean, you have a network of people what are you getting from those people? Is it just their eye, their judgment, their ideas? I mean, is it a whole... Do you choose different people for different reasons?
It's conversations. And sometimes these conversations have started before. Most of the time, actually, these conversations have started before in a different platform, and this becomes, in the case of Berlin Biennale, with the people I was working with, I thought, okay, these conversations that were started in different journeys that I've taken could make sense here,
So it's like a sort
together.
Of practical interpretation of those theoretical discussions you've had, in a way. It becomes almost like a live expression of your...
Yeah, more than I think it kind of gives us a platform, because sometimes the said ideas happen in smaller experimental places, but then now you have a larger canvas,
as it were.
And you really want to see if they would work.
So you've had a little scribble in a corner of a notebook. Now you've got a whole room or something like that, and off you go.
And it's not about taking them and placing them there. This doesn't work either. It's about coming together and having this conversation, which starts from those previous conversations, and some things will be left behind.
Yes, sure.
And some things will enter.
Yeah, yeah.
And then transforms into something else. Yeah.
So that's again, I mean, it's kind of, as you say, you always have to be, I suppose, completely flexible in your approach, but at the same time having some sort of certain guiding principles or ideas that you're not going to compromise on, right?
Absolutely.
So that's the kind of ongoing...
Yeah, it's a dance.
Struggle.
It's
or
a
dance.
Dance.
Okay, dance is better than struggle.
Sometimes you step on each other's toes, and then you move on, and then you find the rhythm, and then,
Because I think that can be, especially in that... I think musicians and artists... In particular, well, I suppose in a lot of projects, even if it's engineers working on a project, there's always different ideas, different egos, different personalities. So you're not only balancing the work, but the people as well.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Can I just ask you a little bit about you?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you born and raised in South Africa?
I'm from Durban.
Oh, So am I.
Oh.
Many years ago. I'm born in London, but I was raised in Durban.
And I lived there. I went to university there.
Did you go to the University of Natal then, Howard College?
Howard College didn't have a fine arts department.
Oh, no, of course, you went to the tech, what was it called?
No, I actually went to what was then called the University of Durban-Westfield.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so
which is now the University of
pre-1990 whatever. Then.
I went there in the early 90s.
Okay, so it was still sort of...
It was still...
not UDW. Fully integrated into...
It wasn't at all.
I did not know that UDW had an arts... Well, no, maybe I did probably know that, but I just forgotten that. Okay, wow.
Yeah, it wasn't so prominent in the landscape of...
no, because, I mean, obviously, in that segregated educational system, I had friends who went to the tech at the time, which was quite a well-renowned art school.
Yeah, with the tech was the... I mean, all the people who are kind of connected to tech, which is now DUT, were the people who were running the art world... In Durban.
Yes, exactly.
Not UDW.
No, right.
There's very few of us who are active right now
who went to
UDW, yes.
Yeah.
But there was a drama department there and a music department.
Yes, right. Okay, now that rings a bell. No, okay, now it's also just something coming back. Oh, really? Oh, that's a shame. And so you're from Durban. And your parents, what did they do?
They are in Durban too.
And are they retired now?
Yes.
Okay.
Working retired.
All right. And where did you go to school? I mean, your high school.
I went to school in Umlazi Township.
Oh, okay. That's where you were raised, in Umlazi.
Yeah.
Geez, yeah, I had one of the best nights of my life in Glebland's hostel once.
Oh, wow.
As a judge for a best dressed man and best dressed woman competition.
That's crazy.
At like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I went to a high school called Ogwini Comprehensive High School.
Right.
And I remember, of course, Cleveland's hostel because they had these sports grounds. So
that's where your school had your. Oh, right. Okay.
Competitions. Yeah. We used to go to those grounds.
Yeah. My mum taught at what was Mangasutu Technicon at the time. I don't know if it's changed. No, she was an English teacher. She used to go out there quite a bit as well. Mm. But then art, how did you get exposed to art, and how did your relationship with art begin? Was it at school?
It began at school.
You had an art class at school?
Yeah, or? When I was in standard 8, grade 10.
Yeah.
Art was introduced in
well, I'll be.
School.
My impression would have been that there wouldn't have been an art school in a high school.
It was the only one. There were only two in the whole KZN, I mean, in the townships.
Yeah.
In black townships. And it was the school I went to, Ogwini.
Fuck.
And the school in Gwamashu, which is called Umzuvele High School.
Those
were the only two schools.
So that was, I mean, quite a fortunate kind of...
Encounter.
Yeah.
It's a funny story because I was very bad at math. And art was introduced as an alternative. I mean, first it was biblical studies. So you could do mathematics, biblical studies, or art.
Sweet choice.
And I went for art, not knowing what I was going for.
Seriously?
Yeah.
My goodness.
I mean, previously I had no exposure.
So you hadn't, you didn't really know.
I had never your skill made a drawing left in my life.
My goodness.
Mean, yeah.
And so what was, I mean, that must have been quite a moment I studied art, and I must have been the worst student that ever. I should have been kicked out of that arts class very early, but I kind of winged it along. But I mean, I did obviously study with guys who were pretty good, and I have people in my family. My sister in particular is a very good drawer, and her daughter as well. It is something, obviously, that people have. Kaiser, my wife, has done a couple of these pieces that you see around here as well. But I mean, there was a moment there that you realized, man, I'm enjoying this, and it looks like I can really express myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like encountering a language you didn't know before.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I was good at it, but I was so intrigued and interested, and especially in the lives of artists.
Right.
You know, I read a lot of books
about
the lives of artists, and I thought, this is the kind of life I want to live.
So who, for example?
I heard about Sekoto in high school, for example.
Yeah.
And I just became so fascinated about his life living in Paris.
Yeah.
At the time, and then I started to look. I was fascinated with Paris, and I thought, this is what I want to do too.
Cool.
Go to Paris and be an artist.
Draw and paint.
And live my life, I don't know, in an interesting way.
Drinking and singing karaoke.
Absolutely. You know, all the things that I'm doing now. But
Did you do history of art as well?
Yes, I did history of art.
Because I'm intrigued now about that experience that I'm sure you've had when you've walked into a gallery and seen in real life a piece of work, a piece of art that you've studied, and you thought, oh, that's quite an amazing piece of art, and then you see it and it completely like blows your mind. Can you think of a moment like that?
The moment actually happened in high school, because the Deben Art Gallery had a show. There was a big show of Sekoto that came to Deben at that time. And I remember the day I went there with some of my classmates. I remember what I was wearing, because it was brand new.
You dressed up for the occasion.
And I remember like seeing, I had a book already of Sekoto, and I remember seeing these pieces, and it's something I cannot describe, you know. And another artist that I was very interested in, the French artist Cezanne, and I copied a lot of his work.
Okay,
as part of the my assignments in high school.
Yeah,
and then I think he's still one of the best painters.
I saw I was in the Uffizi in Florence with my brother, and they just renovated the Botticelli, the Birth of Venus.
Mm-hmm.
And just walked into this room, and this thing was just like, it was golden, just shining. It was almost like it had lights in it shining out. And I never forgotten that. It was kind of, I mean, I don't know. It was just that moment. I'm not a massive sort of Renaissance artist fan or expert, but it was just, you know, I'd seen it in a little color plate in my Helen Gardner History of Art book. And then you see the thing.
Yeah.
Just like really,
it's quite amazing when you encounter a work in the, you know, in person.
Yes.
To be there so close to it.
Do you think about that Sekoto moment when you're curating? I mean, are you looking for?
No, I don't think about
impact.
It.
Impact, no. That's for you.
I don't think about it anymore. I mean, it was a profound moment, that is for sure. And I would never forget it. But when I make my projects, it's not necessarily something I think about.
Okay. Now I was just wondering about that again. That sort of audience art impact kind of relationship.
I think I've become worse. Like I said, I've become worse in terms of how I.
So you're almost beyond.
I look at things.
But it's like you almost have transcended the art then in a way?
I mean, I would hate to say that. I don't think so. I think.
I mean, I'm not even sure what I meant by that. But you know what I'm.
There's just so much out there that is going on,
and
sometimes you just see too many things, and you are only moved.
By certain things.
By certain things. Only, you know, and you remember those moments. You know, and sometimes they happen in an art gallery, in a contemporary art space, but hardly, actually.
Mm.
And for me, they happen more and more in historical spaces.
Hmm.
You know, I remember going to the Museum of, I think it's called the Museum of Fine Art in Vienna, for example, and I was totally moved, like how, you know, these objects that were there were presented, the lighting, and you know, and how they told so many stories that can be unpacked and unpacked. And then immediately I went to a contemporary art museum, and I thought, something is not happening anymore. And I think it's because contemporary art references itself. And I think when contemporary art references itself, it's not interesting.
You mean it has no context apart from like its little whirlpool of...
Yeah, and there is a lot of that. I'm not saying all contemporary art, but there is a lot of that. You know, recently I went to the Museum of Military History in Dresden, in Germany.
Ooh, yeah, nice.
And I was quite blown away by this, you know, by this museum, which is now sees itself as a museum of violence. And then, you know, you start to think about the idea that violence is actually everywhere.
And I mean, Dresden, the city that got bombed to pieces. During the Second World War.
During the Second World War.
Yeah.
At the last ends of the Second World
War. Yes.
Yeah, there's moments like this. There's moments when I went to see Kwesi's show, when I went to see the exhibition at the Standard Bank Art Gallery that Sam Mdluli has curated, you know, and it's really about understanding where we are by kind of bringing these moments in history in order to shape a way forward,
there.
You know? And I think that is the skill. How do you do that? I'm not saying that I'm fascinated by old things. I am looking for a future.
Mm.
And I know that, you know, I cannot discard those things, no matter how problematic they can be. I think, we can bring them, bring the problems, you know, and I think like not shy away from the problems, but also not gentrify the problems, so to speak.
Yeah, or sugarcoat or whatever.
Yeah, or rehabilitate them in some way, but to you know, to create tensions that can produce something else.
Yeah. Because I always, well not always, I'm just, you know, when I do think about art, and I think about what I think the purpose or role of art is, can you admire something just for its beauty as much as for its message, or?
Yes.
Okay. damn.
Yes, I love beautiful things.
Okay, but it's not bad to like beautiful things. I mean, it's just sometimes I do have that debate within myself. You know, can I just simply, because I love Van Gogh's Starry Night or whatever, that's fine. It's not like a call to arms or a call to revolution. Then it's obviously not relevant.
And that is but revolutionary how do you find in itself.
Well, okay, there you go. But I'm saying there is that path you can travel in what art means, and I suppose art does mean different things to different people anyway. Well, people are looking for different things in the art.
Yeah, but people can be moved by different things. And, you know, I think when messages come to us, they reach us differently because we are made of different stuff. You know, so something that might not mean anything to me or not touch me at all, another person would be, you know,
blown away.
And I mean, sometimes out of ignorance, for sure, which is fine. It's a state of mind too. You know, and sometimes I would feel, how can you love this thing because it has so many problems? But
yeah,
you know, other people don't want to see the problems; they just want to see the thing, and
that's okay.
It's okay to a point.
What is for you? I mean, I was saying, you know, my silly story about, you know, South African film, and I'm sort of rambling on to everyone I meet about the South African films going through a great phase now. And somebody said, well, it's always been very productive. And I don't suppose I know enough about the South African art scene, really, but I wanted to ask you just where you see South African art in the context of the last 25 years, particularly in sort of the post-revolution South Africa. Did you have any sort of expectations of where South African art should be, and where do you see it in terms of its, not only its what it's saying, it's sort of technical and maybe metaphysical properties, but just in terms of how South African art is perceived both inside the country and outside the country.
Yeah, I am interested in how South African art speaks. And of course, who it speaks to, who sees it, who is it for? Though all those questions are quite important for me, you know, because at a certain point I was very unsettled. I almost said disappointed, but I think I was very unsettled about how South African art as a, you know, as a package, how it was packaged, how it was transmitted to the world, how, you know. And for me, there was something quite problematic about that.
In a sense,
I think I've said this before in this conversation, in a sense that I become suspicious, suspicious, you know, how artists perhaps are no longer listening, you know, to their own voices, but listening, for example, to the market, what is exhibitable, what is sellable, you know, what is the narrative? I mean, it's also a construction of a narrative. And so, and in my work, I'm always interested in the blind spots, you know, in the cracks in that narrative, because there's always cracks. There is the grand narrative, you know. I'm not interested in that. It is there, and for me to be interested in the cracks, we have to have this grand narrative. But there's always this blind spots and this narrative. You know, and that is my interest, to take something that seems mundane, that seems on the side, you know, that you would not find in any of the, say, post 1994 museums that, or even large scale exhibitions that we see in South Africa. So I become interested in those other stories that kind of sit somewhere in a different unconscious, you know. So I am interested in the unconscious of the South African art world, because I think there that space is quite it's quite I think revealing, uncomfortable, and therefore, you know, something, you know, to work through, and so what was unsettling for me is this, you know, I saw a lot of exhibitions, especially from 2004, that were celebrating a decade of democracy, you know, and how they were packaged, it just seemed so boring, you know. It was like people were doing the same thing differently. It was like JPEGs, you know, blown up.
You talk about, you know, the art market and how kind of niche it is, and the challenge, I suppose, never goes away, does it, an artist that struggle between creativity and commercial success. And so, I mean, is it just the very few and far between artists who are able to find commercial success being very perfectly true to their creative senses?
I find this to be less and less. I mean, this is I think this is my problem. I have no problem whatsoever about commercial success. And often what I observe is that an artist is fresh and then they go into the space and then the work kind of dies. And what I'm wishing for is a space where the art, the money listens to art and not the other way around. You know, the money kind of listens to ideas that are brewing and not, you know, artists being forced to do certain kinds of work because that's gonna sell. And unfortunately, this is what happens. And
is that a universal issue? Do you think it's just something that's specific to our art scene at this particular moment?
Yeah, I think because it's a small scene, you see it much more. But of course, it is a universal thing. But because it's a small scene, you just see it so much more. It's a growing scene at the same time.
Yeah.
And it has its interesting moments, and there are artists there that I know, they, you know, no matter what, they'll be artists.
Gonna, yeah.
You know, no matter what.
Keep at it.
You can put them in a small room, they will make something out of it, you know. And then there's other people who are kind of operating in a different realm. And there's people who operate in a different realm, you know, who have studio assistants, who have a whole system, who are still somehow are able to balance that.
Yes.
But it doesn't often
happen. No, sure. That's what I was saying. Yeah, it's quite few and far between, I suppose. So we need to, unfortunately, time is flying. What's now in the pipeline for you now over the next year or so? Do you have any projects?
I mean, I don't have projects because, I like I said, I don't sit around chasing projects. I was quite exhausted after Berlin. But
you did something at the NSA as well, which I was unfortunate. I missed that. That sounded brilliant. That's the NSA gallery in Durban for people who don't know.
It's the NSA. It's KZNSA.
KZNSA, sorry.
And in January, I did a project working with two younger curators from Durban, just titled Mating Birds Volume 2.
Right.
Which was, I was asked by a friend of mine, Mashati Makanya, who was in the exhibition committee at the KZNSA at the time, and she just said, would you consider doing an exhibition? And I was still in Berlin you know, kind of wrapping up and
recovering.
No, because the I think the Biennale was still on. It was like almost like the last days, and I thought, wow, that could be interesting to do something at home
in your hometown,
in a smaller scale.
Mm.
Yeah, and I just said, yeah, sure,
yeah, no,
I'll do that. I mean, I regretted saying that after some time because I was quite exhausted and just sick. But at the same time, once I was there, staying at the beach, and I think there's something about the city. Once you're at the beach, you don't even feel that you're working. And I think we should just all work by the beach.
Oh, I said that to a mate of mine today. He said, I'm tired. I need a break. I said, you must go to the sea. Go to the ocean.
Yeah. It's the ocean best place is everything. To be. And this project was also about a book or the starting point is a novel, which is which takes place by the sea, by segregated beaches of Durban.
Okay.
So it was important for me to kind of like leave there.
That history.
And to imagine this history and then to create what we call the curatorial essay rather than an exhibition.
Uh-huh.
And so to kind of approach it in a essayistic kind of way by using... by inviting certain artists and works that are existing that speak to these questions, and then using archival material and also some artworks as points of reference.
Right.
So there was a lot of text, a lot of historical material, and then but also works of art by artists. It was
so like a multimedia kind of.
Yeah, you can say
if
that.
I can be old fashioned.
Yeah. So that was quite
good. I read some good things about that. So you're just kind of relaxing for the moment. You do a bit of teaching as well?
Yeah, so though not this year because because of this exhaustion.
Oh, shame.
But at the same time I want to create a space for reflecting on the Berlin Biennale, on everything that occurred. And I think when you just jump into another big project, for example, then
you don't have the time.
You just don't have time. You have all these bits and pieces that are just, you know, there. And I need a space to
you just need some
to
time
collect
now.
But it does mean that I'm very busy because I do say yes to speaking gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And to writing assignments because this helped me to kind of construct certain ideas to tell the story from different perspectives to see what really kind of unfolded there because it's 2 years and then after 2 years another team comes and then you know it's over and I want to stay with it for a little bit, more, for longer,
sure.
In order to kind of see what, you know, how, you know, where we are now, and also how it shaped my thinking.
Oh, that's fascinating, Gabby, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thanks, Nick.
Pleasure meeting
you. Great, yes.
I have to say I was a little nervous going into that discussion. Art is, I'm no expert, really. I've studied art, I've seen art, I appreciate art, but and I know nothing about curating, as you probably heard. But I think we covered some good ground, and I like the part where she talks about, you know, making people work a little bit for their experience and not handing everything to them on a platter when they walk into a space or a gallery or something she's created, curated. And also the role of art in society, and particularly, you know, I suppose in South Africa where, you know, art has played a role in the past of defining a certain historical narrative, an exclusionary narrative. You know, where does South African art find itself today and sort of going forward? Voices from SA is hosted on Audioboom. You may also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.